and a very warm welcome to Singapore and Changi International Airport. The local time is 4:30 in the afternoon.
Hi, this is Jackie Ong. I'm the chair of the scientific committee here in Singapore. Welcome to Singapore.
Okay, welcome everybody to Pickpod number 3. This is going to be the first of our 9 Singapore specials.
Hello, it's Harish Veer. It's nice to be back again, Patrick.
So I got back at the end of last week from Singapore, from the World Congress, which was a fantastic few days.
Okay, Patrick, you obviously look very relaxed and feeling very well. You know, how was your trip to Singapore? Tell us a little bit more about the conference itself.
It was fantastic. So we got there on the Sunday evening, and then straight into 3.5 days of pretty mind-bending PICU conference. It was fun. It's fun medically, intellectually, and socially. And Singapore's an amazing place, but maybe we can talk about that in one of the other specials.
Were you able to meet up with President Trump and President Kim, by the way? You were sharing the same hotel, together.
Not the same hotel, but obviously we brokered any peace deal which was there. It was all very, very bizarre.
Okay.
But whilst I was there, I managed to speak and record interviews with 9 of the speakers on a variety of subjects. And what we're going to do is release each of those interviews as a Singapore special. And we're going to start off today with Aparna Hoskote, who is a cardiac intensivist from Kuala Lumpur Street, who's going to talk about NERS.
Okay, Patrick, I'm really looking forward to listening to her. And then perhaps what we could do is have a few words about the role of NERS in non-cardiac ICUs.
Yep, okay, let's play the interview then. So we're going to talk with our partner Hoskote from Great Ormond Street about NERS. You've just been involved in a debate, and you took the standpoint that NERS should not be routine monitoring on PICU, is that right?
Yes, I was part of a debate where we debated on whether NERS is necessary in the intensive care unit. I think on this score, I debated against it. But of course, NERS has some advantages that it is non-invasive, it is continuous. However, it is not necessarily reliable. It does not necessarily correlate with the measures of cardiac output, such as mixed venous saturation. And also that if one has to use NERS, it has to be used in the context of understanding its limitations. We also don't have algorithms for intervention. We also don't have thresholds for what we should be aiming for as targets when we use it in the ICU. There are some scenarios, such as, you know, a very sick patient post cardiac surgery, where it may be used as a trend monitor. And in the trend, what I mean is you assess what the saturation is at baseline, and then you follow that up for a period of time to see if there is any change, and if there is a significant drop, or if there is a slow change drift in the NERS saturation, then it may suggest that some monitoring or some more assessment of the patient needs to be done. The most important thing is that NERS should be considered as an adjunct to the existing hemodynamic monitoring.
Some of the studies and the graphs which are shown in the debate showed that the NERS had changed either pre or post cardiac arrest. One showed that there was a reduced signal pre cardiac arrest, and one showed that on resumption of output there's an increased signal. However, on both those graphs, for instance, for the pre cardiac arrest one, there's also a change in the heart rate beforehand, and the post cardiac arrest one, there's an increase in the ETCO2. Would those be, you know, both of those are standard monitoring, they're cheap, they're easy, they're installed already. So the question is NERS just showing us what our monitoring is showing us already, was it showing us something different as well?
I think NIRS definitely, the numbers, whether it is tissue oxygenation for the brain or for the splanchnic, will definitely change when any particular change happens, such as in the blood pressure or when in the process of cardiac arrest. I think it can be seen to add value to the already existing hemodynamic monitoring. It cannot replace or substitute the monitoring that we have.
We're not a cardiac unit, and lots of some of these studies have been done in post-cardiac surgery patients and bypass patients and so on. But using TBI and in sepsis and in just critically ill patients is important as well. Especially, I think, in TBI, because that's a very much all about keeping the brain perfused and oxygenated. That would make sense for to me. Yeah, but one of the issues with it is if you have blood around the monitor, and obviously in TBI, there's lots of blood in the skin. There's blood beneath the skin. There's blood the blood in the extradural space. How much would that affect the signaling?
So if there is blood, yes, it can affect the oxygenation signal. So definitely, any such thing like that will affect the scatter of the oxygen near infrared lights, and hence you will have, you know, potential artifacts from extracranial blood.
Lots of the correlation graphs as well, the scatter plots which are shown, the R squareds were all 0.6, 0.65, and there were nice lines superimposing them, but the lines look pretty superimposed. Now there's a huge amount of variation. Lots of patients with low NIRS with high cardiac outputs, and vice versa as well. Can really use a monitor which has R squareds in the 0.6 region? Isn't that just too inaccurate and too random?
Yes, that just shows how it cannot be used as a substitute for already existing hemodynamic monitoring, and it can only add some value, but it cannot replace. Almost all the studies and the graphs were of small number of patients, and it's important to remember that with NIRS that there can be artifacts, there can be signal shift, especially with contact of the sensor to the skin. So you need to have a very robust mechanism to analyze the NIRS data in such a way that you can draw conclusions from it.
We just had a vote in the session. I think about 65% of the people there said it shouldn't be necessary monitoring. How often do you use NIRS in your patients?
We don't use it routinely. We use it for some select group of patients, such as the extremely sick or high-risk neonates after cardiac surgery. We also use it in some of our ECMO patients, particularly when we are doing some interventions on them, like decannulation, where it may tell us how the patient is coping with weaning of ECMO flows. We also have now started using it for our VAD patients, where the routine hemodynamic monitoring is probably not as reliable because it's not pulsatile.
And how often do you believe it as well?
I think that's a difficult question. If the NIRS was to change on its own with no change in any of the other hemodynamic monitoring, then my first reaction is to go and look at the sensor to see whether it's, whether it is properly placed on the patient, and then that prompts me to look at the other hemodynamic variables or monitors that are on the patient. So I tend to always give that sense of importance to it, in the sense that I will go and assess the patient. I may not necessarily intervene if everything else is okay, but I will mark that situation or that episode in the patient to be tracked and, you know, monitored.
And final question, should I go home and buy one?
NIRS is a very expensive technology, and it's been in the medical field for the last 40 years, and yet it has not become an established practice, and I think there is considerable equipoise. I don't mind if you buy it and use it, but all I would say is that if you use it with discretion, use it with knowing its limitations fully well.
Thank you, partner. Thank you. So in summary, after that interview, and actually watching the presentation, I wasn't overly convinced and impressed by this technology.
Patrick, what is interesting is that I originally got involved in the use of NIRS close to 20 years ago, and we were evaluating the equipment, and we realized that, one, the equipment was expensive, and secondly, I think I certainly had no great enthusiasm for its use in general PICU. It's interesting that 20 years later, listening to Aparna, it feels that as if she's not all that convinced either of its great use in intensive care.
What wasn't clear to me was what this monitor adds to normal practice. If there were graphs shown and correlations shown with other determinants of cardiac output and determinants of health, and yet I'm not sure why we need a monitor to show us what our standard monitors are actually showing us already.
I think there are certainly advantages. I think it able to give us non-invasive, real-time and continuous measurement of regional tissue oxygen saturation. However, I think the limitations are that the measurement is often very local and not necessarily indicate global hypoperfusion. And this is where the conflict arises.
But the perfusion, that depends on where you're monitoring it. If you're treating a child with low cardiac output state because of their heart, then surely their perfusion is globally poor. And if you're looking at a local problem, so for instance a traumatic brain injury, which would be of great interest to us, in those patients there's so much possibility of problems with blood in the tissues and blood around the skull that it can't be used either.
That's great. I mean, what is interesting is that if you look at the literature around the subject, virtually all the publications are regarding cardiac.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I think its use in general pediatric non-cardiac ICU is very limited. And as I said, 20 years down the road, I'm still a bit uncertain at this role in non-cardiac patients.
So what's different about a patient who has a low cardiac output state due to their heart, and the patient has got low cardiac output state due to other reasons, so for instance sepsis or so on, and they both have whole body total global low cardiac output states. Why would I use a regional monitor for those states?
I agree. I think, you know, it's a role in there was a role for it, it should have caught on and should have been used in other scenarios as well.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to have, I'm afraid.
I'm always keen on new technology, and as you know, we use a lot of cardiac output monitoring and electrical impedance tomography on our units. And there's technology which catches on, and there's technology which doesn't catch on. But essentially, it seems to me that the people who have the novel technology, and generally those who use it are very keen on it, and those who don't just haven't done it. I don't see that enthusiasm for NIRS.
I think one of the other unfortunate things is that there are obviously other interferences as far as the measurement is concerned. There's apart from the scalp, skull, dura, and etc., there is evidence that in individuals where there is hyperbilirubinemia or excessive melanin, there will be reduction in the oxygen saturation relative to regional venous measurements. And I think, as I said, you know, it's still 20 years down the road, it's still a new tool. It needs to be evaluated in a proper sort of way. At the moment, the vast majority of studies that you see are all individual case reports.
I agree with you, Harish. I mean, I think in summary, I think this is promising technology, but unfortunately, it's been around for 20 years and hasn't really been shown to add much more than what we know already.
I think so. Perhaps it's about time we realise that the old-fashioned tested tests, such as lactates, etc., need to be continued to be used in intensive care.
So we've saved a bit of cash and then carry on with our Singapore specials, and see you next time.
Yeah, then, bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to London Heathrow. The local time is approaching 5:40 in the morning.